Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. Tonight, we are bringing you episode 45, and the date is February 5th, 2015. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
Ray, I've got a timeline for right to start out, but we're starting on the 17th, but this is a timeline for the 11th and the 12th, because we had a big break from where we ended last week. Like around the 9th until we start again here. And two things that were going on, that for the 11th, it says Rommel's forces are now stalemated before El Alamein, largely because of a lack of ammunition. Then on the 15th, because it's related to Rommel, it said that the only action around El Alamein is light skirmishing. So that lasted for quite a while, probably up until our current time. And then also another thing on the 12th, it now becomes clear that Stalingrad is the largest challenge to the Germans. Well, I don't know who that became clear to, but anyway, that's what Wikipedia says, it becomes clear. So they're involved with Stalingrad pretty heavily. And a balloon from Operation Outward knocks out a power station near Leipzig. And these balloons are interesting. And the British, I was reading about it, but it was last week that I read it. But the British came up with this balloon warfare, you might say, or whatever, tactics. And some of the balloons had firepower in them or bombs in them or something that could be dropped. And some of the balloons were trailing wires that could interrupt lines, power lines, and so on. And they did have quite a bit of success with this one. They launched, I forget now the number, thousands of these balloons, maybe hundreds of thousands of them. Didn't really accomplish that much, but this one they knocked out a power station near Leipzig, and it was due to one of those trailing wires. And the reason that the whole power station caught on fire is because they determined that there was a fault in the electrical work or something. And that's why that got affected, and when that happened, it caught on fire. Otherwise, it would have just, I suppose, broke it down a little bit. But that's an interesting thing. And then they had this thing called, I don't know if these are the same balloons, but they had balloons that they would put up, and then pilots coming in to do some damage on either side would run into these balloons. And sometimes it could cause your plane to crash or not operate properly. So they are pretty dangerous. But I know in reading the things from Leopold Wenger, he got, for a while there, he was mentioning those, and I forget now what they were called, some kind of balloons. Maybe you remember, but he was mentioning those balloons all the time when they were flying over Britain, you know, the southern end of Britain. And they had a lot of them, and they were always you know, having to deal with those balloons. But he didn't seem to think they stopped him at all.
Well, when you started with that, right away it came to my mind that the Brits came up with the idea one way to help defend London, particularly at night when the Germans couldn't see them, was to send up a smaller version of the dirigible, the Goodyear blimp, so to speak, with maybe 3-4 cables, steel wire cables hanging down from that dirigible, you know, 50-100 feet, and those cables hanging in the air out there, suspended in the air from those dirigibles. If a plane hit that, I mean, there goes a wing. It gets knocked down, and they were used in that manner, and they were shaped like dirigibles. But as far as the balloons that, you know, they let drift over Europe and into Germany, like you said, the one about Leipzig, I imagine it was something very, very similar. And if a cable's like that hit electric wires, certainly it could be very disruptive. Mm-hmm. And especially if there were explosives in the carrying part of that balloon.
Right, some of them had explosives. I read it was like there was two different kinds. Some had explosives and some had these cables attached. But then these other balloons you kept in your own country, and they were like defensive things that they had all over in those towns that that the Germans were targeting during the battle during that time. 42 and so on. And that was a big deal. Well, all right.
Okay, we'll get into 17th of July, 1942, midday. Radio control in Russia, and Goebbels fails. In the neighborhood of our werewolf headquarters, we found that almost every house was provided with a wired wireless. This shows that the Russians had realized in good time the dangers of a wireless receiving set. For one thing, the wired wireless has the great advantage that it eliminates all interference. And for another, it permits the state to choose the broadcast which it considers suitable. In Russia, the commissar chooses the programs, and the listeners are therefore completely cut off from the influence of foreign propaganda. Before the war, I myself directed the Minister for Propaganda to introduce wired wireless in Germany. In this way, German listeners would have been able to receive only our own national stations and such foreign broadcasts as we decided to retransmit. I'm very sorry that we were not able to apply these measures before the conflict started. It was a bad piece of work on the part of the Ministry of Propaganda, for although Dr. Goebbels has tried to put the blame onto other services, it is he who is responsible for the failure. When the execution of an order demands the cooperation of several services, he who receives the original order must assume the responsibility for the execution of the whole. The desirability of introducing wired wireless is indisputable. No government can permit its population to be poisoned by enemy propaganda. Otherwise, one might as well invite 1,000 enemy propagandists to come over and do their work openly. All measures of this nature should be examined in peacetime with an eye to their probable effects in time of war. For war is a life and death struggle, which has its own rules and ignores the normalities of peace. A people which is prepared to accept compulsory military service of 3 or 4 years as a preparation for a possible war will not mind the slight inconvenience of a changeover from wireless to wired wireless.
Well, I found that really interesting.
I did too.
Yeah.
Mainly because I was trying to figure out the difference between the two in my mind. A radio set, a wireless, you know, I know I've seen those in those World War II movies they make and things like this, and they'll show them. And then a wired wireless would be something akin to, I guess, modern-day cable where you can only get certain stations.
Right.
Certain frequencies. And the wireless will pick up whatever's transmitted from anywhere if it has the capable range.
Right. I think of it as like the difference between, what are those radios called that used to be so popular for alternative truth movement when we didn't have so much internet? Shortwave.
Ham radio.
Shortwave radio.
Yeah. Shortwave. Uh-huh.
And then with a regular radio where you only could get what was being broadcast, but the other, they pick up all sorts of things. So I didn't understand it at first either, but I figured that's the way I took it. Finally.
Yeah.
Something like that
good.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hitler is actually saying that Goebbels fell down on the job there, and he's not taking any excuses that obviously Goebbels gave him, that he told the people what to do, but they didn't do it. And he's making it clear that when you're given the job, it's up to you to see that they do it.
Right.
I like that. Good for
him. Yeah.
Adolf.
That's true.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. We'll move on to the 17th of July, 1942, at dinner. Self-satisfaction of the Italians. The Italians have a remarkable aptitude for arrogating to themselves all sorts of virtues without, in reality, ever having accomplished any of the exploits which would result from them. This is particularly noticeable in the manner in which, in their history of fascism, they describe the last phases of the First World War. According to it, the Allied victory in 1918 was due to the virile action of the Italians. The same idea crops up as regards our campaign in 1940, during which they claim their attitude of non-belligerency tied down at least 60 French divisions. now that French official sources disclosed that not 60, but 7 French divisions were holding the Italian frontier during the Western campaign, and that even of these 7, 3 were withdrawn without any particular difficulty. The Italians are feeling proportionally shamefaced, but they will quickly get over it. They can take a hiding after hiding for 3 unbroken years in succession, and then, if one day they suddenly achieve some minor success, all the buffets are forgotten and the whole peninsula bursts into songs of triumph. That short little section there kind of, it just affirms the impression that I had of Italy as an ally, during that war.
Well, Hitler seems to be coming out more and more with complaining about the Italians, and probably because of he's got good reasons to, whereas in the beginning he was trying to praise them a lot, and he never stopped praising Mussolini, but now he says
he
just doesn't have as good a stuff to work with or something. It's not his fault. But, this is a Latin thing. I don't want to insult the Italians at all. I'm very sorry, but... being familiar with Mexico, they have that same tendency. They have hardly ever, the Mexicans, they've never had a military success, but they had that one 5th of May, which wasn't a, they didn't win the war, they lost the war, but they won this one battle, an important battle. And that's their great thing that they trumpet all the time, Cinco de Mayo. So they don't let it bother them. Latins, they have this zest for life, I guess, and this high opinion of themselves or whatever. Anyway, they're going to be happy, so they're not going to let that stuff get them down.
Right, more of a live for today crew, and don't worry about tomorrow or next week or next year until it gets here.
Yeah.
Okay, 18th of July, 1942, at dinner. Motor roads going east, the Autobahn and the cinema, the Autobahn and the shortening of space, railways and national unity, the economics of the Autobahn, Lloyd George, a man of method. Once we have secured our grip on the eastern territories by means of the construction of a network of Autobahnen, the problems of distance, which worry us a little today, will cease to exist. Of what importance will the 1,000-kilometer stretch to the Crimea be when we can cover it at 80 kilometers an hour along the Autobahn and do the whole distance easily in 2 days? I am absolutely determined to link up the whole of the eastern territories behind the East Wall by means of a network of Autobahnen radiating from Berlin. The normal 7.5-meter road will, however, be inadequate for the purpose. Instead, I shall at once construct an 11-meter road capable of taking 3 lanes of continuous traffic, slow-moving lorries on the right, normal traffic in the center, and swift-moving traffic on the left. When one recalls that in pre-war Germany we have built more than 2,000 kilometers of motor highway, I'm surprised that the film industry has not made a great film out of the story. Unfortunately, however, we, unlike the British and the French, do not make films of our great achievements. The one exception is Vienna, and Vienna figures so often in films that I'm sick and tired of the sight of the place. I know of only one film which has the Autobahn as its background, a wretched slapstick affair in which 2 lovers chase each other along the highway. And even there, not only is the story and the handling of the film miserable in the extreme, but they did not even select a particularly good section of Autobahn on which to make it. The film, incidentally, had a terrific success in Upper Bavaria. When we are able to go from Klagenfurt to Trondheim and from Hamburg to the Crimea along Reich's Autobahn, we shall have a system of communications which will shorten space to the same degree as the old carriage highways for the conception of their time. The Autobahnen have proved immensely valuable from the political as well as from the transportation point of view. One of their greatest services is that they have swept away the internal frontiers of the Reich, and now one goes from one province to another without noticing it. In the days of the old highways, the numerous toll gates and the differences in surface made one only too aware of provincial boundaries. Once over the Mecklenburg border, for instance, the potholes reduced one's speed to 10 or 15 kilometers an hour, and one was very lucky if one escaped without broken springs. The state railways, too, have, of course, made their contribution to the process of the unification of the German races. But in contrast to the Autobahn, on which even the little Volkswagen can skip in three bounds from the Alps to the North Sea, the train, with its innumerable stops, still draws attention to the old boundaries. Everything combines to remind one that once upon a time there were the Royal Bavarian Railways, the Royal Württemberg Railways, and even, as Bormann has just reminded me, the Grand Ducal Friedrich Franz von Mecklenburg Railway Company. Dynastic interest proved too strong for the railways. This is just one further confirmation of the fact that it would never have been possible to form a united German Reich if the princes had not been swept aside. Each of these princes built and developed his railway system as the spirit moved him. The Autobahn, on the other hand, where uniformity in all aspects has been the guiding principle, allows anyone to travel anywhere he likes and still feel at home. It is only after passing the frontier of the Reich, and this I would emphasize most strongly, that he may expect to meet the first pothole. That no one before me thought of building these Autobahnen is due probably to the fact that the central administration never scientifically worked out the financing of the project. In road construction, the system was prevalent whereby the local authorities in each small locality through which the highway was to run were called upon to defray the costs of construction in the territory under their jurisdiction. With such an idea, no wonder the scheme did not achieve much. When I studied the financial aspect of the project, I came to the conclusion that 1,000 kilometers of Autobahn should be constructed each year, and that the central government should contribute a milliard marks annually to finance it. One day I explained to Lloyd George how I proposed to find this money. Firstly, I intended to get my labor by mobilizing all the unemployed and putting them to work, thus saving some 600 million marks in dole payments. Secondly, I intended to increase the income tax and the tax on petrol to an extent that would bring an estimated revenue of 400 million marks, and thus my Autobahn would cost the state nothing. During our conversation, that old fox Lloyd George asked me what thickness of concrete I proposed to use. The American motor highways have 5 or 6 centimeters of concrete, and Lloyd George could hardly believe me when I told him that ours would have from 25 to 30 centimeters. Indeed, Kempka told me later that one day Lloyd George stopped his car, pulled a tape measure out of his pocket, and verified the correctness of what I had told him. The war shows how right I was. Even direct hits from bombs have caused only minor damage on the Autobahnen. But the war, alas, has obliged us to change their appearance and to paint them black in order to render them invisible to hostile aircraft. Those who know how near to my heart the Autobahnen lie will be able to appreciate how much it hurts me no longer to be able to bowl along those lovely white tracks.
Aww.
How about that? You know?
Yeah. He really did love the Autobahn. God, he loved roads. He loved car travel. And he loved this Autobahn. And when he says up here, one of the things I was going to comment on, when he mentions going from a town down in Austria all the way to Klagenfurt to Trondheim. Trondheim is in Norway, and Klagenfurt is the far southern Austria. So, he wants a road to be, he wants people to be able to go all the way from southern Austria to Norway, nonstop on the Autobahn. And you can tell that when he says he wants to go from Hamburg to the Crimea, too. You know, that's a darn long way. So he's got big dreams. What did you want to comment on there before I have a couple more little things here?
Well, I wanted to say, to me, the most overwhelming aspect of his thoughts on this was how much he realized what a unifying force building those roads and eliminating, if you call it precinct borders, or the different principalities that originally had financed some work in their location, and toll booths were set up and things like this. But when the Autobahn was built, and he brings it out here, he says, you know, you could take off on that and go and travel and still feel at home. And what he meant there, of course, was the unifying effect. You're still in Germany, by golly, and it's not a thing about Bavaria or the other different principalities.
That's right.
And so that's, to me, how he recognized such a thing as building roads linking the whole country that could be free to travel without toll booths and checkpoints and all this stuff, and how unifying that could be.
It leads me to realize, which I've been forced to do before this, in reading this, that he would today probably approve of the European Union, except he wouldn't approve of the people who are running it.
Right.
You know, but he would approve of the idea of the European Union because he was just always in this book talking about unifying
cooperation.
Europe. And here it's very clear where he says you don't want to have to stop at the border and change everything, and it just, you know, he loves the idea you go right through. And that's the idea for Europeans with the European Union, that they can avoid all those bothersome things. But the problem is the people who are implementing it. And he would be fighting them. Well, then here, when he says he would contribute a million marks annually to finance the Autobahn, didn't we determine previously that a milliard is a billion?
Yeah.
Yeah, the German milliard was.
Yeah, I think that that's what we realized. And he said he could get the within 600 million and then 400 million marks. You know, one of them was taking people off the dole, putting them to work. The other one was taxes on petrol and income tax. And that would bring in exactly what it would cost to build it, and that was money already really being collected and spent or handed out. So, borrowing from a Federal Reserve Bank to go into debt to take on that project.
Yeah, it was a great project. It was one. It started right away. It was part of what put Germany back to work and everything, and it was just success, and they still got it, you know, in spite of the way they'd like to get rid of everything that Hitler did, but they've still got that Autobahn. They're not going to get rid of that, and they've still got the Volkswagen, too.
Mm-hmm. All right. 18th July, 1942.
Oh, yeah, I've got a timeline here. The timeline for the 18th is the Germans test fly the Messerschmitt 262 V3, the third prototype, using only its jet engines for the first time. So here we are in, July 1942, and they're first flying this prototype that uses jet engines only, only using its jet engines. Yep.
Right. I just wish they'd have had that thing ready in 1938.
Yeah.
That could have been a hell of a factor. So, okay. Ready to move on, or you have some more, Carolyn?
No, that's it.
Okay. 18th July, 1942, evening. An interview on the war on the Eastern Front. What I shall say about the Second Front. To enable me to make some retort to the constant allusions to a second front in the British press, I have instructed Dr. Dietrich to arrange an interview for me with a foreign journalist on the subject of the Eastern Front. As each individual picks from an interview of this sort the things which to him, which seem to him personally to be the most important, I hope to be able to touch on the subject of the second front in an oblique way. I propose to develop the idea that as the British are children in military affairs, we must, of course, be prepared for anything, however foolish, and that we cannot therefore dismiss out of hand all the twaddle written in the Anglo-Jewish press, but that in the same way as our preparations allowed us to counter the onslaught of the Russians, we are now taking all the necessary steps to prepare a worthy reception for such unfortunate British soldiers as may be led by those military non-entities who command them to attempt a landing on the coast of Europe. I shall treat the subject of the Second Front in a manner that will become a cold douche to the British. I shall not say that I do not believe in the possibility of a Second Front, for that would jeopardize the whole object of the interview. I shall, on the contrary, emphasize that German military precision and thoroughness ensure that we are prepared for any and every eventuality, including that of a Second Front. In accordance with Dr. Dietrich's recommendation, I have agreed that this interview should be granted to some foreign journalist who has already shown appreciation of the German press and its work. Whether he be the representative of a country great or small, neutral or friendly, is of no consequence, for as the Reich press chief rightly says, this interview will certainly be reproduced in the whole world press. I could, of course, give my opinions on the Second Front in a public speech, but to make a speech without having a specific reason for it is always a bad practice. The intelligent man will swiftly see through the ruse and recognize the real object behind it. And if this object is too blatantly apparent, the desired effect will be completely ruined. On the other hand, if the question of the Second Front is introduced obliquely in the course of an interview on the Eastern Theater of Operations, I can, I am sure, convey exactly the impression I desire in a few incidental sentences.
Well, I found that really interesting. And I wonder if he gave that interview and who he gave it to and what it is. You know, it doesn't say
That's
in
right.
here. They don't give you any notes about things. So
it was something that was followed up. I imagine it was followed up on.
Yeah, I do
because,
too.
You know, because it's such a subject that's being bandied about everywhere, you know, and I'm sure the German homeland is worried and about it and concerned that there may be that the Allies are going to open up a second front, and that would be an invasion of Europe at some point, and I'm sure it's on their minds, and so Hitler's taking this chance to partially at least defuse the situation by letting everybody know in this interview that they're aware of it, and they are prepared to handle it if and when it comes. And then he throws in the fact that poor British soldiers that are going to be led by the idiots who believe in this, you know, if they attempt a landing, that it's going to be very unfortunate for them.
Right. He's putting out his propaganda, and it sounds like he's thinking about everything, you know, and I think that's pretty good. I think that's a good way to approach it, and the good things to say too.
Oh yeah,
saying we're prepared, so you better watch out. You know, you think you can just come over here like that? And they, of course, they did kill a bunches of them.
Yes,
when that did happen. But unfortunately, you know, there was treason. I call it that. You might call it confusion, but it was more than confusion. Treason
that's
on the
right.
German side. By the time
right.
that happened, and that made it
later.
Yeah. So.
That's true. Canaris.
He was part of it. There was a lot more of them, though.
Oh yeah, that's right. He was one of the biggies in it. 19th of July, 1942.
Oh, here I have another. I'm sorry, I have a timeline.
Okay.
I don't know why I don't recognize these right away. This is for the 19th. The Battle of the Atlantic, German Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz orders the last U-boats to withdraw from their United States Atlantic coast positions in response to an increasingly effective American convoy system. So we've been talking about the great success that German U-boats have been having over there on the American coast, but they finally caught on there and improved improve their effectiveness, and so the Germans can no longer do what they were doing, and they've decided to withdraw.
Right.
Good idea. Good decision.
Yes, sir. Okay. 19th July, 1942, midday. Naval warfare. The advantage of little ships. Sea and superstition. When a battleship is sunk, the loss of life may be as high as 2,000 souls. But if we could construct a mass of tiny craft, each fitted with a torpedo tube and manned by a single man, the losses we should suffer would be fractional in comparison, and the successes from the combat point of view might well be considerably greater. Many years ago, I once asked Graf Luckner why he always used comparatively small craft for his world sailing tours. Luckner gave me the significant answer that when anything goes wrong on a big ship, people save themselves by getting into little boats. One might therefore just as well start off at once in the latter and have done with it. Luckner, of course, was a marvelous spinner of yarns, and I could listen to him for hours on end. One day, someone or other explained to me that certain of Luckner's statements were nonsense, and I was as angry with my informant as a child who has been deprived of his Christmas tree. The Fuhrer then asked Admiral Kroenke if he could explain the origin of the terms a seaman's yarn and spinning a yarn. The Admiral replied that in the old days, on long voyages, the sailors, bored with the same food and the eternal sea and having but few books to read, passed their spare hours telling each other stories, which grew taller and taller, and at the same time fashioning yarn nets for fishing and so on. Hence the expressions. The Fuhrer continued, I once had an ex-sailor as a servant. At all hours of the day and night, the fellow used to try to spin me yarns which any fool could see were nonsense. In the end, I had to tell him that I was quite as good a liar as he was and that he must not tempt me to try to go one better. As even that did not stop him, we were forced to part company. A thing which always strikes me about sailors' tales is the great part that superstition plays in them. Sailors, apparently, are like actors in this respect. In the lives of both, there occur unexpected events which they cannot possibly foresee and with which they cannot cope. The sailor never knows when a storm or even a hurricane will descend on him, and the actor cannot tell whether the audience will receive him with applause or with derisory whistling, and so they are both extremely superstitious. Superstition, I think, is a factor one must take into consideration when assessing human conduct, even though one may rise superior to it oneself and laugh at it. It was for this reason, to give you a concrete example, that I once advised the Duce not to initiate a certain action on the 13th of the month. For the same reason, I think it is a bad thing to let a ship sail on a Friday, because all old salts know that a Friday sailing is unlucky. Such things are the imponderables of life, which one cannot afford to neglect, for those who believe in them are quite capable at a moment of crisis of causing the greatest consternation. Just when the difficulties of the Eastern winter campaign in the East had reached their height, some imbecile pointed out that Napoleon, like ourselves, had started his Russian campaign on June 22nd. Thank God I was able to counter that drive with the authoritative statement of historians of repute that Napoleon's campaign did not, in fact, begin until June 23rd. The horoscope, in which the Anglo-Saxons in particular have great faith, is another swindle whose significance must not be underestimated. Just think of the trouble given to the British General Staff by the publication by a well-known astrologer of a horoscope foretelling final victory in this war for Germany. All the newspapers in Britain had to dig out all the false prophecies previously published by this eminent quack and reprint them before public anxiety could be pacified. In judging any question connected with superstition, it must be remembered that although an oracle's prophecies may be wrong 100 times when they are promptly forgotten, it suffices for one prophecy to be fortuitously confirmed by a subsequent event for it to be believed, cherished, and handed down from generation to generation.
Boy, that last is so true. You know,
yeah.
And that he settled on that. I mean, that is so true that, well, with a lot of things, you can tell 100 lies. But if you say one thing that comes out right,
well,
all the lies are forgotten about.
yeah. Hmm. And, you know, another thing that crossed my mind on this, Carolyn, you know, I've read a lot of garbage regarding Hitler, just as anybody that studied him has, because most of it is lies, Allied war propaganda, whatever it may be. But there have been mention in some articles that I've read about him that he was had his own astrologers, because he was a firm believer in the horoscopes and astronomy and, you know, astrology, things like this. And
right. And
then, you know, to see him say the horoscope, in which the Anglo-Saxons in particular have great faith, is another swindle. So, anyway.
He didn't like any of that stuff. So, anymore from this, you can say people can just, whenever any of these things are brought up that are any kind of New Agey type of thing, you know, even if it's not actually New Age, but, you know, falls under that heading, you can just dismiss that because he didn't like any of it.
Right.
And, you know, I thought, though, I like this very much. I like it when he just gets kind of lighthearted about things. And
I do, too.
When he says, when he explained this Admiral Kronecker, explained the seaman's yarn and the spinning of yarn, that was pretty good, I thought. I never knew, never thought much about that, but I'll take that explanation. For good,
yeah.
So I thought that was interesting. And go ahead.
And also, when you know, you're saying that he's talking about how much this superstition is just so much baloney, but that a person would be remiss in totally casting it aside or ignoring it simply because of what it means to so many other people.
Right.
And in other words, that the, let's say the masses generally are sort of a bit superstitious about things, and they put a little faith into it. So it wouldn't be wise to just try to totally junk it and tell everybody it's a bunch of old wives' tales or a bunch of hooey, because then you probably would drive off a bunch of them as far as trusting your leadership. So it's he's very well aware. Hey, let them go on with
their
superstitions and believe what they want.
Yeah, and you have to make your public decisions on that basis. And that it would be wrong to do something, say, on a Friday the 13th. And then if it fails, they'll say, well, that dumb Hitler did this thing on Friday the 13th, should have known. And then it could go from there to, well, he did it on purpose because he's working for the enemy and all this stuff. So you have to be very careful. Is what he's pointing out. Boy, it takes a lot of thought to keep from getting in trouble with things like this. Okay, well, now we're going to another timeline, which is the 20th.
Okay.
And on July 20th, after landing in the Bunagona area, the Japanese in New Guinea move across the Owen Stanley mountain range, aiming at Port Moresby in the southeastern part of the island, close to Australia.
Right.
A small Australian force begins rear guard action on the Kokoda track. So there we are. I have no idea about that, but obviously those Japanese, they were covering such a huge territory. You wonder how they thought they could manage to keep control of that huge area.
Yeah.
But I guess they thought they had to, huh?
Yeah, stretching supply lines very thin. But, you know, they were after the Southeast Asia oil fields and a lot of goods and production that the Dutch had invested in over there. And and they just felt like once they got into it, just keep driving ahead for all they were worth. And they met, as we know, tremendous success on battlefields until they started losing some naval battles to the United States Navy.
Yeah, and, see, when the United States came in, it was the beginning of the end for both Japan and Germany. They screwed up the works. And they started these things out just thinking about, I suppose, their European and Asian peoples and countries and so on, and not considering the U.S., but, in the beginning, but that's what happened there. But you're right, they're going to use a lot of things against you. You have to take charge of all of it. So the Japanese challenge was the same as the German challenge. They had to cover such vast distances and to go after those resources.
Right. Yeah. Right. And, the Japanese had the mindset, correctly so, too, that North and South America, that Western Hemisphere, they considered, yes, the protector of the United States and to be exploited at will for industrial purposes and for trade goods, things like this, that it was the American market to the United States. Europe belonged to primarily British with their colonies here and there and whatever and their strength. And they looked upon themselves as the nation that very well should be the head of the Asian sphere of influence. And so they felt that rightly a nation should step up, as England had done, as the United States was doing, in gaining control of a huge geographical area and be the boss of it. Because why stick around and wait to see if someone else is going to do it? I mean, who's going to do it? The Philippines? The Chinese, maybe? Who knows? Mm-hmm. But so Japan had that impetus to establish that, and they felt like they tried to reason with the United States about a sphere of influence, being it rightfully that Japan was doing nothing more than America had done. And, of course, that wouldn't fly because of British, Dutch, and American interests in the Pacific theater and things like this. But that was their emphasis.
And that's always been it, isn't it? But, damned America always wants, and the British, too, want to have their interests protected everywhere, all over the world.
Yes, right.
That's how it looks to me.
Deny the most prosperous and industrious nation in Asia,
right.
Japan, the right to establish that same thing for themselves.
Yeah, I feel like the Japanese. I think the Japanese should be that have play that role
right.
in Asia. They're
right.
the best ones to do it.
True. And they felt too. They felt that way in the 1930s. So.
Yeah, then they got sidetracked just like Germany with all that guilt. So they had to cower down and play it quiet, and now they don't know where to go or how to begin or
right.
whatever.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay, 21st July 1942 at dinner. Society in France, a ruling class which retains its powers. It is characteristic of the French that every well-to-do citizen, be he businessman, officer, famous artist, or a prominent politician, always buys himself, generally in the village or district of his origin, a little house with a neat garden. The result is that in almost every French village you find among the mass of nondescript cottages one or more handsome villas belonging to an advocate, a painter, a cotton spinner, or the like. The French upper classes usually spend 2 or 3 months in the country and thus acquire an affection for the land, the political importance of which must not be overlooked. Gradually, they get to know each individual villager and thus very quickly become associated with all the joys and sorrows, great and small, of the simplest and at the same time most solid class of the population. There is, in state affairs, no finer way of binding the upper classes to the interests of the country. And that's really good. That's a heck of an observation, is the importance of land, of course, And if you get members of the French, as he says, upper class or ruling class, to establish themselves in small villages with the little people and feel the pulse and heartbeat of what goes on and befriend them and be interested in them, as he says, there's no finer way of binding the upper classes to the interest of the country, to have an interest.
Mm-hmm.
And
he's saying that you know, the French have always been this way, and the French are still a little bit ahead of things that way. For all their, you know, the true French love the country, and they still identify with the French people and the French nation and all of that stuff, and like to spend time there. So that's still a quality that is there in France. But the trouble with France is there's so many foreigners there that it's they're not, you know, that's not French, that are not French.
Right.
But I liked that, too. I thought that was a good observation he was making, and very friendly, and very honest and fair to the French.
That's right. 22nd, July, 1942, midday. King of England and Duke of Normandy, the Channel Islands and the Frisian Isles, those who work and those who reap. The inhabitants of the Channel Islands, which we occupy, consider themselves as members of the British Empire rather than as subjects of the king, whom they still regard not as king, but as the Duke of Normandy. If our occupation troops play their cards properly, we shall have no difficulties there. I do not approve of the suggestion made to me that these islands should be colonized by people from Friesland and the Ems regions. For whereas these latter are primarily marsh dwellers and cattle drovers, the inhabitants of the islands themselves are first and foremost small farmers. If the British had continued to hold these islands, fortifying them and constructing aerodromes on them, they could have been a veritable thorn in our flesh. As it is, we have now firmly established ourselves there, and with the fortifications we have constructed and the permanent garrison of a whole division, we have ensured against the possibility of the islands ever falling again into the hands of the British. After the war, they can be handed over to Lee. That's L-E-Y.
Lay. We're talking about Robert Lay, who's the head of some of these. He's actually the head of the workers, you know, people, and this organization is for the workers.
Yes, and that's coming up right here. Can be handed over to Lay, for with their wonderful climate, they constitute a marvelous health resort for the Strength Through Joy organization. The islands are full of hotels as it is, so very little construction will be needed to turn them into ideal rest centers. The Italians could have got a hold of a similar prize if, on entering the war, they had occupied Cyprus. Unfortunately, however, they restricted their military activities to a declaration that now they regard themselves as being in a state of war. And that, if you please, after we had shown them in Norway how things should be done. The average Italian of today is a mighty trencherman at the table, but a weedy warrior in war. How very different are the men of the Caucasian tribes, who are about the finest and proudest men to be found between Europe and Asia.
Well, that was interesting now. He said the Caucasian tribes, and I was thinking, well, I wonder who he's referring to there as the Caucasian tribes. But he does say that they're the finest and proudest men to be found between Europe and Asia.
Yes.
Not in Europe, so I caught on to that. And he said they're amongst, you know, between Europe and Asia, these are the best.
Right.
And the Caucasian tribes are supposedly like countries like Georgia, aren't they? And some of those that were part of Russia or under the control of Russia, and then they kind of got liberated by the Germans. For a while.
Yeah.
I think those are the ones he's referring to.
Yeah, and you know, possibly even other countries that border Russia are real close to it. And I know they're considered European, but maybe Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and that area.
Well, I don't think those are Caucasian, though. I mean, because the Caucasus is down south.
So more like the
Balkans or something, you know.
Yeah.
The Balkans and on east. Hard to say who he had in mind, but, you know, they were utilizing a lot of those people by now or starting to. You know, most of it came in 43 and mostly in 44, but they were starting to work with those people. And now here again, let's look and see what a good opinion he had. We're going to have a section here, which I guess we'll get to, where he's again talking about Ukrainians, and they're going on and on about what they don't want to let the Ukrainians do. But that is, you know, they're talking among themselves, and they've already discussed this, so they're discussing it again. They must have a little bit of concern for it, that they bring it up and talk about it again and again. But it makes you think that they have no respect for these people. But that really was not true. Even though what they're saying there, they respect them because they know that if they allow it, they'll overcome the Germans. You know, that they have a lot going for them, and they can overcome the Germans. And one thing they want is to have German control, which you can't blame them for that. That's what everybody was wanting in what they were doing. So anyway, I don't want to jump into that now. So let's go on if you don't want to say more about the...
Okay, the 22nd of July, 1942, at dinner. Lawyers not admitted. Thief does not rob thief. Crocodile tears for sale at a fee. Let me issue a word of warning to our legal gentlemen that they should refrain from attempting to impose their mania for regulations on the administration of our eastern territories. It is typical of lawyers that, according to their doctrine, while I have the absolute right as Chancellor of the Reich to sign and promulgate laws and decrees affecting hundreds of millions of marks, I am not legally allowed to sign a will disposing of, say, 10 marks without having my signature witnessed by a lawyer. I had to make a special law in order to rid us of this pedantry. As long as I'm here, there is no great danger to be feared from the lawyers. Whenever necessary, I shall ride roughshod over their formalities, but I am worried about the future. A little while ago, I took steps which enable me to put a stop to their little games when they become really harmful. I was forced to do so because up to now these crooks were answerable for their conduct only to their own legal tribunals, in which it was axiomatic that thief does not rob thief. But I soon put a stop to that. During our period of struggle, I had plenty of personal experience with these gentlemen. I am sometimes told that I am confusing the lawyers who flourished under the Weimar Republic with their successors of today, who are quite different. I disagree absolutely. The very curriculum for the training of a lawyer ensures that the rising generation will be just the same smart alecks as their predecessors. How can you describe as honest a profession which, from its beginning to end, is engaged in defending blackguards, and in which the fervor of their eloquence is in direct ratio to their client's capacity to pay? Look at Ludger Brunner. He can work himself up to a tempest of tears, provided sufficient pennies are put in the slot. How can they dare claim that they are furthering the cause of justice when they whisper advice in the ears of criminals and conduct their examinations in the most dubious manner? Whenever I witness the disgusting performance, I always feel, here we have the master fox teaching the little fox the way to go. In olden times, it was the strolling player who was buried in the public refuse heap. Today, it's the lawyer who should be buried there. No one stands closer in mentality to the criminal than the lawyer. And if you can see much difference between them, I can't. The only way to clean up this profession is to nationalize it. And I think, incidentally, that it is scandalous that these people should be entitled to call themselves doctor. I saw a lot of humor in that, and you know, I got to throw in a little bit here. I had a little bit of experience working for an attorney as an investigator for a couple of years. And where Hitler here says no one stands closer in mentality to the criminal than the lawyer, he pretty well hit the nail on the head, because a lot of my duties were inside work, and his attorney particularly that I worked for, I had to, like when he was defending someone in a trial, he would send me to go get records, get paperwork here, there, and I had occasion at a trial to sit in on it. And boy, there was a point up in the courtroom where the fellow that employed me, the defense lawyer, he really got into it with the prosecution. They were yelling, and the judge had to say, "All right, now, beat this gavel and all this stuff." And you would have thought they were coming to blows. And a few minutes later, they said, "Okay, we're going to break for lunch. Let's return to the courtroom at 2 o'clock. So my boss, you know, he waved to me to follow him, and I brought his briefcase and all, and we headed down the hallway out of the courtroom and through the double doors, which only the people, court officials, were going down. And here was my boss and that prosecuting attorney walking side by side, and these were the guys that you thought a minute ago were going to tear each other apart. And the prosecutor looks at him and says, "Hey, where'd you come up with that move you made a while ago?" And said, and they were laughing. And I realized this whole thing is a play. It's a sham. It's those guys, you know, they'd probably be very good actors, because it was all a dadgum sham. And I just shook my head. And that was just one incident that made me realize that, you know, these guys, they're in it for the money. Sure, they got to make a living. But Hitler's disgusted with them because of their compromising with their moral principles that they may never have. And
right.
I kind of like the way he talked about them here.
Oh, yeah, and he's always going after the lawyers. He sure doesn't like lawyers.
That's right. yep.
He thinks that probably most societies, and that in Germany, they need a leader like him who will overrule some of these things, because they put everybody in the hock, sort of, to speak, with their law associations. And what I liked was when he said that, well, that they have their own organizations to judge what they're doing, and
yes,
nobody else can do it, you see. And tribunals. They're only answerable to their own legal tribunals. And that's right. If there's wrongdoing by people in the judiciary, well, these judiciary tribunals make the decision on that. And that's the same thing in the medical profession, isn't it, Ray, that doctors are only answerable to their own medical organizations, and they say because nobody else is qualified to do it, only the medical people. They get away with murder, and they stop alternative medical practices from ever getting anywhere. They do a lot of terrible things. So the doctors and the lawyers that get so much respect in society and have so much prestige are some of the biggest, you might say they're bad for society in so many ways, and some of the biggest crooks and so on. And he's absolutely right.
Well, sure. And that's why he says, and a thief will not steal from a thief. And, of course, what he means there is, guilty lawyers are going to find other guilty lawyers innocent, and they're the ones that judge them and just turn them loose to just further their practice.
Then he's mad that they can call themselves doctor, the lawyers.
That's right.
on with him. Boy, we sure miss Hitler. We need Hitler. Don't we?
I'm telling you, we do. Okay, this next section is rather lengthy, and so we may, if you feel the need to comment, please jump right in.
Okay.
22nd of July, 1942, after dinner, Russia's two main weapons, we beat time. Let us admire Stalin. Adults and infants of the Ukraine, contraception should be encouraged. The danger of racial pressure in the eastern territories. Local population, the right policy. German administration and the cockchafer hunters. The Soviets could have become a mortal danger to us if they had succeeded in undermining the military spirit of our soldiers with the slogan of the German Communist Party, "No More War." For at the same time as they were trying by a Communist Party terrorism, by strikes, by their press, and by every other mean at their disposal to ensure the triumph of pacifism in our country, the Russians were building up an enormous army. Disregarding the namby-pamby utterances about humanitarianism, which they spread so assiduously in Germany, in their own country they drove their workers to an astonishing degree, and the Soviet worker was taught by means of the Stakhanov system to work both harder and longer than his counterpart in either Germany or the capitalist states. The more we see of conditions in Russia, the more thankful we must be that we struck in time. In another 10 years, there would have sprung up in Russia a mass of industrial centers, inaccessible to attack, which would have produced armaments on an inexhaustible scale, while the rest of Europe would have degenerated into a defenseless plaything of Soviet policy.
I'll stop right here. Because I was wondering about that Stakhanov system, so I looked it up, and it's called the Stakhanovite Movement. Began during the second five-year plan in the Soviet Union in 1935 as a new stage of the socialist competition. It actually wasn't started by the government, I don't think, but came about because it was named after this man, Alexei Stakhanov, who had mined 102 tons of coal in less than 6 hours, which was 14 times his quota. So he was some kind of a real Superman type.
Innovator.
He-Man, well, I mean, a worker. I mean, he mined 14
right.
times his quota of coal. And followers soon broke his own record. They got so carried away with doing this. And on February 1st, 1936, Nikita Isatov mined 607 tons of coal in a single shift. So these people were like, you know, trying to outdo each other. Well, the government saw that that was pretty great, and they started instituting that. The Soviet Union started instituting that all around the place, and they had this Stakhanovite movement going on, and they were, for some of the people anyway, joined in with the mood of it and really worked hard to get these, to win and get these medals and so on. They had a bunch of medals that they gave out and all, so... Hitler's bringing this up because saying what the potential was in this country,
yes.
And if they hadn't invaded when they did, what was going on there, and more of this production would have been going on. It would have been inaccessible to the Germans. So he's always realizing, and you know, everybody should realize that the Germans struck not any too soon, and should say that they should not have attacked on the East because, oh my, you can't fight a two-front war, and it was just suicide. Well, that's the only thing that they didn't win in the end, but they sure did slow the whole thing down, what could have happened when the Russians were ready to, the Soviets were ready to just enter into Europe and defeat everybody.
Yeah, and the ironic or false thing about those, you know, complaining that Germany was foolish to strike as early as they did. They didn't strike early enough. And I think the military would agree, had they struck in March instead of June, they probably would have overwhelmed Moscow and kicked Russians.
Well, there's two things there, though, that, you know, Hitler has said in these table talks that because of the spring weather, they would have gotten bogged down in the muck and mire. And so, in the end, he thought they were fortunate to have waited until June. But then that meant, though, they didn't know that terrible winter was coming up, see? Who knew?
That's true.
That horrible winter that makes it seem like they should have started sooner, and then they would have gotten further. But he said they wouldn't have. But at the same time, they were going to start then. And, it was the Italians and their stupid mistake and their stupid actions down there in Greece that caused that delay for Germany and for all of us. So, you know, they'd had the plan to start sooner in May, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or maybe it was moved up a couple of times, but ended up being the end of June.
Right.
Well.
But that stacking off system that you looked up and defined there, that's very good. And, of course, what it did was increase productivity astonishingly. And
yeah.
And he was right. Hitler was right observing that. And if we're ready to move on to that next paragraph, the first thing he says, it is very stupid to sneer at the Stakhanov system. The arms and equipment of the Russian armies are the best proof of its efficiency in the handling of industrial manpower. Stalin, too, must command our unconditional respect. In his own way, he is a hell of a fellow. He knows his models, Genghis Khan and the others, very well, and the scope of his industrial planning is exceeded only by our own four-year plan. And there is no doubt that he is quite determined that there shall be in Russia no unemployment such as one finds in such capitalist states as the United States of America. Bormann, who has just returned from a tour of inspection of the Kolkhoz in the vicinity of General Headquarters, gave his impressions. And this is Bormann speaking. When one looks at the children, it's difficult to realize that sooner or later, they too will acquire the flat Slav faces of their parents. Like the inhabitants of the Baltic states, they are fair, with blue eyes, bonny and chubby-faced. In comparison, our children look like tottering little chicks. It really is curious to think that these children will become Ukrainian adults with their vulgar, inexpressive faces. I was much struck by the fact that in these huge open spaces, one saw so many children and so few men. Such prolific breeding may one day give us a knotty problem to solve, for as a race, they are much hardier by nature than we are. The men have admirable teeth, and rarely does one see a man wearing glasses. They are well fed and bursting with good health at all ages. The difficult conditions under which these men have lived for centuries have brought into being a merciless process of selection. If one of us drinks a drop of their water, he all but dies. They, on the other hand, live in the dirt, drink the muddy, stagnant water of their ponds, and thrive on it. We fill ourselves with quinine as a safeguard against malaria, while the Ukrainians are so immune not only to malaria, but to scarlet fever as well, that they can live with impunity in surroundings teeming with fleas and ticks. If these people are allowed under German supervision, that is, under greatly improved conditions, to multiply too quickly, it will be against our interest, for the racial pressures which these damn Ukrainians will exercise will constitute a real danger. Our interests demand just the reverse. Namely, that these territories, hitherto Russian, should in time be populated by a larger number of German colonists than local inhabitants.
Okay, let me just comment here on what Bormann has said. And, you know, Bormann is very, very, very pro-German and very much, not...
Nationalist.
And he went there and took a tour with close to where the headquarters was, actually, and just is saying what he thinks about it, and he's pointing out that, you know, he thinks Germans are superior people, but these people have a lot going for them, and he's concerned.
Yeah.
But he also says here, and I didn't fail to notice that he said, if these people are allowed under German supervision, that is under greatly improved conditions. So they know that under German supervision, they're going to be living in improved conditions. They're not going to be living in worse conditions. They could hardly get much worse than they already were under Soviet and the long time they've been associated with Russia. Anyway, so he's saying that, you know, we have to be careful that we don't help them to become strong and overthrow us. So that's all I wanted to point out. Because, you know, Bormann's going to get a real bad report on this, you know, because he says something like flat Slav faces and things like that, you know, I'm just so racist and hateful,
But. Yeah, even though a lot of what he said was pretty complimentary of those people.
Absolutely.
Really. He said they're hardier than we are, their teeth are good, They can drink the water. We drink one drop of it, and we're sick
as a dog.
He
says they're bursting with good health. So,
yes.
That's why they're admiring the Ukrainian people in their conversations at headquarters there, and some of them would go out and look around and visit with people and so on. And the Ukrainian people were very friendly, and they thought highly of them, and they hoped to do some great things there. Really, okay.
Okay. Hitler commented, after what we've just heard Bormann say here, "I recently read an article from the pen of some Herr Doktor advocating the prohibition of the sale in the occupied territories of contraceptives. If any criminal lunatic should really try to introduce this measure, I'd soon have his head off. In view of the extraordinary fertility of the local inhabitants, we should be only too pleased to encourage the women and the girls to practice the arts of contraception at all times. Far from prohibiting the sale of contraceptives, therefore, we should do our utmost to encourage it. We should call on the Jews for help. With their unrivaled sense of commerce, they're the very people for the job. In all seriousness, however, there is a very real danger that these local inhabitants will increase too rapidly under our care and domination. Their conditions of life will inevitably improve under our jurisdiction. We must take all the measures necessary to ensure that the non-German population does not increase at an excessive rate. In these circumstances, it would be sheer folly to place at their disposal a health service such as we know it in Germany, and so no inoculations and other preventive measures for the natives. We must even try to stifle any desire for such things by persuading them that vaccination and the like are really most dangerous. It is, furthermore, essential to avoid doing anything which might give rise to a feeling of superiority or of racial pride among the natives. This is of the utmost importance, for it is only by the creation of the very reverse state of mind that we shall be able to prepare the ground for the accomplishment of our plans. For these reasons, the local population must be given no facilities for higher education. A failure on our part in this respect would simply plant the seeds of future opposition to our rule. Schools, of course, they must have, and they must pay for their tuition. But there is no need to teach them much more than, say, the meaning of the various road signs. Instruction in geography can be restricted to one single sentence. The capital of the Reich is Berlin, a city which everyone should try to visit once in his lifetime. Finally, elementary instruction in reading and writing in German will complete the course. Mathematics and such like are quite unnecessary."
Now, I just want to say here, too, that he said all this in almost the exact same words before. So they've got this conversation down, kind of, and they're just going over it again for whatever reason. But you can imagine that they're talking among themselves, and they're trying to be prepared for what they need to be doing. And other countries, other leaders in other countries, talked just the same as this. No matter what they might say out in public, you know, is one thing. But what they thought and what they would have said amongst their inner circle is something else again. And you know, Churchill said terrible things about non-British people, Roosevelt and in the United States they probably did too.
Sure.
But they didn't publish it. And this happened to be that they thought that they wanted to keep these words of Hitler's for the party membership, you know, to stay within the party. But because of what happened, because of the destruction and so on, well, others eventually got hold of it, and now it's a public thing. But I want to put a lot of things in perspective that I think people want to take it and just attack Hitler for it, for what he's saying.
Well, that's a good point. And a good time to say it, too.
Okay. I won't say anymore.
In setting up the educational system, the same principles apply to both Eastern territories and any other colonies. We do not want any of this Enlightenment nonsense propagated by an advance guard of parsons. What is the use of talking about progress to people like that? Yodel is quite right when he says that notices in the Ukrainian language, "Beware of the trains," are superfluous. What on earth does it matter if one or two more locals get run over by the trains? I am in favor of teaching a little German in the school simply because this will facilitate our administration. Otherwise, every time some German instruction is disobeyed, the local inhabitant will come along with the excuse that he didn't understand. For the same reason, the Russian script must be replaced by the Latin. The greatest possible mistake we could make would be to take the local population too much under the wing of the state, and to avoid all danger of our own people becoming too soft-hearted and too humane toward them, we must keep the German colonies strictly separated from the local inhabitants.
You know, when he says the Russian script, he means the Russian alphabet should be replaced by our alphabet.
Yeah.
Right.
Germans will in no circumstances live in a Ukrainian town. If essential, it will be better to put Germans in barracks outside a town rather than to allow them live inside it. Otherwise, sooner or later, the process of cleaning up and improving the town will inevitably start. And Russian and Ukrainian towns are not in any circumstances to be improved or made more habitable. It is not our mission to lead the local inhabitants to a higher standard of life. And our ultimate object must be to build towns and villages exclusively for Germans and absolutely separate from Russian or Ukrainian towns. The houses to be constructed for the Germans must in no respect resemble those of the Russians, and lime plaster and thatched roofs will not be used. In pre-war Germany, everything was too meticulous and too stylized. One reason for this is that we Germans were compelled to cluster in such close proximity that the police had no option from time to time to issue regulations for the conduct of communal life. This craze for regimentation, however, carried with it this danger, that when any German found himself settled abroad, in a British dominion, for example, he would sigh with relief at his freedom of action and movement, and very soon become estranged from his German fatherland. We must in no circumstances repeat the mistakes of excessive regimentation in the Eastern territories. If we wish to avoid antagonizing the local population, we must restrict our interference with their local habits and customs to the minimum compatible with our interests. In pre-war Germany, things had got to such a state that Berlin wanted a finger in the pie whenever the mayor of any town was being elected. They even wanted to forbid dog breeding, and I had personally to intervene in order to restore permission to the dog fanciers. The unfortunate cockchafer associations were overwhelmed by a deluge of regulations from Berlin with paragraphs governing the administration, finances, audit, and God knows what else, and holding the president of the association personally responsible for compliance. As regards the Eastern territories, therefore, I wish only broad instructions to be issued from Berlin. The settlement of day-to-day issues can safely be left in the hands of the respective regional commissars. I propose further to reduce the danger of regimentation in the Eastern territories by reducing the German administrative machine in them to an absolute minimum, and seeing that the regional commissar deals with and through the local mayors. I do not, of course, intend that out of this should grow anything in the nature of a Ukrainian civil service.
That's positive, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
What are you saying there? It somewhat mitigates what he was saying earlier. Before we close off, I do want to comment that last night as I was putting things for the blog talk, getting images for the blog talk post page, I came upon this website that had all these color photographs of Ukraine and Ukrainian people from 1942, exactly what we're talking about here. And I used three of them on there, but there's a whole bunch of them, and they're absolutely beautiful, beautiful. And I'm gonna link to it on the Carolyn Yeager program post too, so people can look at them. But I realized I was so absolutely taken up, and I've always been attracted to things Ukrainian. So I think I have a real strong affinity for Ukraine, and the landscape in Ukraine is absolutely gorgeous to my eyes and my mind. Fertile and rolling hills, and I saw one picture that I looked like a Bruegel painting. And I thought for sure I think it is a painting because it was so perfect in the composition and so on. And the one figure in it kind of looked like he was painted. But since everything else was at least 20 or 25 pictures were all photographs, I'm sure that one was too.
Yeah.
You know, I really have a liking for Ukraine and Ukrainians, and that's probably why I take the Ukrainian side in this current dispute that's going on. And in fact, it's more than a dispute, a big, terrible war, but I really do, and I hope the best for the Ukrainians. And I do believe that Hitler and the Germans really looked forward to working, well, it's hard to put it into words because of the things they say, which don't sound too good.
Yeah.
And, of course, they couldn't have a partnership because they had to be in charge. And Ukrainians were not up to the German standards in any way. You know, they had a certain... intellectual class, but for the most part, the people really did live pretty primitively. But still, it was beautiful. Their houses, their neighborhoods, a little shanty looking sometimes, but I rather like that. And it's quite beautiful. So I hope everybody enjoys those photographs. And that's how do you want to end this show?
Okay. Well, I'll just tell our listeners that in our book, we are approximately 130 pages till the end of it. And at the rate we're going, mid to late April, we should have this done. I would say maybe 10 weeks at the average of maybe 14 pages each show. And that just give them some idea how much time we have left. And so I hope stay with us and all. But that's where we stand.
Thanks for that information. It's always good to know. I'm sure they will stick with us. I'm going to say good night for us and come back next week, ladies and gentlemen.